Welcome to the latest edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your semi-helpful host, Director of Online Content at SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. This week's podcast, we discuss the book Superhighway, Sea Power in the 21st Century, with its author, Admiral Chris Perry, Royal Navy, retired. I'd like to take a moment out to thank the folks at William & Mary's Project on International Peace and Security for availing me of this opportunity to interview Admiral Perry. We discuss his intentions in writing the book, his thoughts on the changing nature of sea power, and how a shifting climate will change the security environment. We also discuss new technologies, what a future naval conflict may look like, and how powers like Russia and China are pushing their agenda at sea without crossing the escalatory line of conflict, and how the West may answer those challenges. This was a lovely conversation, made especially more lovely by the fact it was in a bed and breakfast with little leather chairs and bookshelves, which felt supremely British, fitting our guest. The only thing that would have made it even more appropriate would have been us drinking tea instead of coffee, but I invite you to kick back, relax, and we will be back with Admiral Perry after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control Podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SIMSEC website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
First of all, I really like this book.
Good, I'm glad. Even though I don't spell defense right.
Well, that's okay. I can't remember if I saw the word color in here at all, to see if there were any U's in
There's
it.
There's lots, yeah.
And I could hear... I don't think I read the word aluminium either, so I guess I've missed out on the best parts of proper English language. If you don't mind, and we can do it either way, sort of our conversation, I'd love to use it as a podcast.
Sure.
I guess to start out, my question was, sort of what was your intention?
Well, one of the things we suffer from in the United Kingdom as a society, and I think it's increasingly so in the United States, is a thing called sea blindness. I think that society in general doesn't appreciate what they owe to the sea in terms of trade, in terms of movement across it, and the fact that it's a medium for power projection. And I think we need to raise an awareness of that sort of thing.
And so what I kind of took this as was, you know, on the back, the publisher put, who will rule the waves in the 21st century? It didn't seem like that was the question you were going to answer. It seemed like more you wanted the question to be posed in full. This seemed almost like a primer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid I don't get to write what's on the sleeve. That's the publisher's job. And the first time you see it is actually when it appears on the bookshelves. So it was as much a surprise to me as it was to you. So you're absolutely right. I mean, my essential aim in all of this was to say, look, the sea is the physical equivalent of the World Wide Web. Everything that goes virtually goes actually either over, through, or under the sea. And if we lose control of the sea, it's the same as losing control of the internet. We deny ourselves the benefits of globalization. And I was thinking, with rising powers like China, Russia, trying to close down both the internet for their people and the high seas for its use by everybody else, it seemed a good time to point that out and see how 500 years of the use of the sea as a global commons could be absolutely curtailed by the actions of states in the future.
Now, first of all, I thought that was just an excellent observation with the comparison to the internet. When did you start thinking about the sea commons like that?
Well, I think, I mean, it's not my original thought. It's been around for some time, about a century now. But of course, the
I'm sorry, the comparison to the internet where you did the conference.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if you go back to, everybody knows Mon, and everybody at Annapolis knows about Mon, and he said, you know, the sea's a great highway. And of course, it's an easy jump in one's mind to say, well, actually, it's a superhighway because it connects the whole world. It's globalized. And the really interesting thing, of course, is that the internet is carried by submarine cables that go under the sea. So the connection's actually physically quite close. And once one got that into one's head, you then thought, well, hang on, who writes the code for operating at sea? Well, you have to learn all the techniques of actually operating at sea. It's not something everybody can do. So the real geeks are the guys who operate at sea. And if you go back to the 15th century, the guys who put to sea then really needed deep technical knowledge to actually go out onto the oceans and beyond to discover the Americas and beyond and things like that. So there was a bit of a conceit, I think, in probably comparing the two. But I think the key linkage is globalization, both physical and virtual. And if we want to benefit from that, if we want to continue to be prosperous, stable and secure, then that's what we have to do. We have to be out there. And for the last 60 years, it's been the United States Navy predominantly that has guaranteed that safety and security with its allies. We need that to continue. And we mustn't allow our politicians or our publics to get confused about that.
There are two sections of this book that I'd like to talk about in particular. The first one that I really enjoyed is how you went into the change in sea power. So you discussed, you know, there's the common understanding, when I say common, sort of amongst the folks that think about sea lines of communication, but you went into the issue of sea mining, of being able to use the resources of the sea. How will that really change? Because we talk about sea control, the concept of controlling the sea lines of communication, and, you know, the debates about doing that or doing convoys, et cetera, et cetera. Now, all of a sudden, the sea is becoming a place where you have lots of cables, of infrastructure, where this whole place will become littered with steady state pieces of infrastructure that now must be defended, where in the past it was something that we passed through. I don't know if you could maybe talk a little bit how you think that'll change the way we think about it and pursue maritime security.
Well, just as technology allowed our forebears to go out on the oceans in the 15th and 16th century, technology is now allowing us to exploit the resources of the sea. That's oil and gas, that's mineral resources, and it's fish, of course, the organic resources of the water column. Now, accompanying that is a desire by states and companies to territorialize the sea. So the seabed suddenly is becoming territory, and we particularly see this in the East and South China Seas, with China looking to extend its jurisdiction way beyond what the UN conventional law of the sea allows. And it is a blatant land grab. In the book, I call it a land grab.
Absolutely.
And if one sees the sea as land covered with water, but actually has a lot of resources in it, then one can see how this is going to take place in a much more crowded and increasingly crowded world, occupied by 10.2 billion people by 2050, needing all the resources to come together in order to feed, to water them, and also to give them a standard of living which everybody expects now in this internet age.
So the sort of, I guess it leads well into it, as we're talking about building all this infrastructure and all these resources under the sea, your section on the environment, talking about us being covered by the sea, would you say, and I detected almost a tone of resignation, sort of, we don't want to get into the debate about climate change. Climate change is a thing that's existed for a thousand years. The way you talk about multiple modalities to deal with that climate change, do you see it more of a resistance or an embracing of the change of the climate? Because you give a lot of methodologies, but I never got the sense that you said, you know, this is something we should combat or something we should just synthesize into the way we're moving forward.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of debate about climate change. And if you get over trying to mitigate what the planet's trying to do. We as a human race have actually got to adapt to what's happening. We've got to deal, and we as military men always adapt to what we see in front of us. And I have to tell you that I'm a great believer in putting our money into adapting to what is happening. I don't think we've got much chance. And I speak as somebody who's been studying this for over 25 years now. I don't think you've got much chance of mitigating the temperatures. So if the temperatures are changing, as they have done over thousands of years, then we've got to adapt. We've got to sort out ways of moving people who get threatened by sea level rises. We've got to build defences. We've got, obviously, to move away from arid climate to get desertification and get all the water drying up on land. And we've got a big task on our hand to redeploy our resources and assets to make sure that the minimum number of people are affected by climate change. And only this week, the Pentagon's strategy for dealing with climate change has come out. And you know, they've got a strong grip on what's going to happen, regardless of what we do to try and bring down the temperature, which I think, my own view, is that that is probably a fruitless attempt. Because the climate has changed, it will change in future, and it's changing in front of our very eyes. And if you just go down the road to Norfolk, minor changes in sea level are going to create real problems for Norfolk Naval Station.
So to get into the how we adapt, what was kind of your favorite discovery? You talk a little about geoengineering in this book, which is, I love reading about that kind of, it's straight out of science fiction, which is insane because it's not anymore. Much of it's science fact. What was the favorite thing that you, maybe something new you had read about and said, well, that's rather interesting. I didn't know we could do that.
Well, I mean, the problem with geoengineering at the moment is that the jury's still out, and we've got a whole series of unintended consequences. We've had iron filings put into the Southern Ocean, and that's created algal blooms that have totally deprived the ocean of oxygen. And so that's a non-starter. You know, we're talking about putting lots of stuff up into space to try and keep the sun's rays out. I mean, somebody told me recently that when Krakatoa erupted in 1883, it put a layer of ash around the planet that's kept us 2 degrees cooler ever since. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but it sounds about right. And that's what we're trying to do, perhaps. But I think in the face of Mother Nature and a huge biosphere that has its own mind, we're probably not doing very much in terms of geoengineering. And I don't have much faith in that. I think my own view is let's go with the flow of the world to see how it's going. Let's try and measure the rate of change. Let's try and adapt to it. And for the reason the human race is still on the planet is that it's shown remarkable adaptability in the face of climate change in the past. We should continue to do that. We have the technology, the ingenuity, and the resources to do so. My worry is that millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of people are going to have to change their way of life and find somewhere else to live. And that's a big migration, even greater than the sort of urbanization that we're seeing today.
Well, to that point, so much of what you're talking about, the innovations in technology that you're talking about in your book is the, I'm forgetting the phrase, is the necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. So the another golden age of technology as people try to adapt to these new problems. So that's sort of the fun, friendly things, talking about the environment and technology and commerce. You get into the security competition and the security environment. What do you think, I suppose, as a professional Navy man, what would a modern day or a future naval conflict look like? Because there's so much technology. We talk about lasers, we talk about drones, and then you throw in, oh, by the way, EMPs, which might, there's so many different factors, there's so many different things. There's been a debate about whether or not, with all the missile technology and A2AD, whether or not the modern naval conflict would be quick and sharp, with just within 30 minutes deciding which fleet is left as all the missiles fly up into the air, or if it would be a long slog that we're more familiar with. And having written this book and from your experience, you know, what would a 10-car pileup on this superhighway look like? And what are your greatest fears about that?
Well, my greatest fears relate to technologies that perhaps haven't been developed yet. You mentioned EMP. I mean, we've got some fairly powerful weapons coming on board soon: directed energy, rail guns, possibly even particle beam, which has the same sort of change, same revolutionary change that the atomic weapon would have had back in the 1940s. So will these be developed over the next 20 to 30 years? Some of them will be. There's no doubt about that. My own view about how conflict will develop in future is it's going to be, I think, a contest between ambitious, aspiring and adventurous powers testing how good they are against the existing status quo powers. And it'll take the form of a series of encounter actions, I think. You're going to find that they'll test whether the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea is going to be upheld by the United States and the Western powers. And we'll see these encounter actions taking place at sea, probably one-on-one. So commanders are going to have to take the initiative and see what happens there, obviously guided by their political masters. I don't think we're going to see major fleet actions in the short term. And it'll be pointless for us to think that's going to happen. The Chinese fleet is not going to sally out, for example, and look for a couple of carrier battle groups to encounter like a Midway. Not yet, anyway. I think in the near term, there'll be a lot of testing to see where relative weight is, to see how certain platforms measure against each other, whether, for example, the Chinese A2AD systems can actually cope with two carrier battle groups sitting very close to Taiwan or South Korea or something like that. At the moment, I don't think they can. I think the US has a certain predominance. I think the key issue is whether we in the West are confronted with the death of a thousand cuts. So all over the world ocean, we find ourselves confronted by Russia or China, and we're being challenged as to whether we will uphold the freedom of the seas and the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. And I'm convinced that we're in an era now where Russia, China, Iran, and other powers will challenge conventions that they say they didn't subscribe to originally and only signed because it suited them at the time. They don't agree with that anymore. And I think more and more we're going to see these challenges. So it may well be the next time the Cowpens approaches the Chinese carrier, there may be an encounter action. And what's really interesting there is the difference between manned encounter actions and unmanned encounter actions. So, for example, if an unmanned drone meets another one and destroys it, it doesn't have the same meaning as if it's a manned one. So how many drones are you going to lose before you get serious and send in a manned platform actually to commit? It's going to be a very interesting sort of commander's dilemma in all these circumstances.
Does it make it easier to disengage, or does it make it easier to slowly escalate as you send more and more unmanned? It's an interesting...
We're in a new dynamic, and I think we haven't gamed it, you know. And I'm just thinking, you know, Japan has going to have three or four Global Hawks. What happens if she loses three or four Global Hawks down in the East China Sea? How does Japan respond to that? And what if the next thing that comes into Japanese airspace is two Chinese fighters, for example? Do they get splashed? You know, we're getting intrusions into NATO airspace by Russian aircraft at the moment around Europe. Should they come down? Obviously not in the current political persuasion, but other times they might. And it's going to be this constant testing, I think, of the limits of toleration, which will be the pattern in future. I think with modern sophisticated societies, it's going to be very difficult to initiate the sort of grand fleet action that we've had in the past. But those forces at sea will be necessary in order to deter the sort of action that we're trying to avoid. Without a comparative balance of forces, the one that feels he's strongest will always take his chance. And with warfare at sea, there's always the balance of relative power, not overall power, that counts. And one of the things that worries me about overcoming A2 and AD is that actually it might be the wrong question. Why would you want to go and fight in there? That's the issue. It may not be the fight you want. And so we need to think our way around this. If we're going to coerce China, if we're going to encourage China to be a responsible member of the international community, trying to test ourselves against China's A2AD perhaps is not the issue.
Now, you bring up the issue of death by a thousand cuts. So something that you talk about in your book is the Chinese specifically using a mix of military and non-military options to sort of using, it's not soft power, but to passively, aggressively push its agenda. And I think there's sort of a bifurcation in the book, a specific one to discuss maritime security versus sort of hard naval power. And what's your thought on that? Is there a balance that's missing with the free world when it comes to, I have Russia, I have China, they're using these passive-aggressive means, either it's the Little Green Men in Crimea, or it's the quote-unquote Coast Guard that China's driving around the nine-dash line. Is the problem that I'm sending destroyers and cruisers and carriers, these big pieces of very powerful naval hardware, and when I should be sending something more akin to what they're sending, so I can shoulder their vessels, so I can meet them on that passive-aggressive plane that they're playing in? Or do you think that it's a different application of what we have now? What's that balance of force that you see? Kind of, is the future really going to be this more low-end forces and less committed conflicts? How do you see that future evolving for the West dealing with this death by the salami slicing?
Yeah, if you look at the investment that goes into smaller forces by Russia and China, you'll see that they are considerably better armed and given considerably better sensors than some of our PCs and patrol craft. I mean, I look at some of the British patrol craft that have a 30mm gun and a helicopter if they're lucky. And you're looking at a Russian equivalent that has pretty serious surface missiles, rapid fire guns, all sorts of things. So they're taking it seriously. The fact of life is that you can afford to send something that matches, say, a Chinese Coast Guard cutter if over the horizon you've got something significant. If you just go mano a mano to one of these lower level type of vessels with nothing behind it, then you are almost encouraging some sort of action, some sort of trial of strength. I've never thought, and I still don't think it's a good idea to actually play down to the level of your opponent. You've got to encourage him to stay at that level while you maintain effortless superiority. Now, in the book, I say that I think there is an issue about the supercarriers as to whether they will go in harm's way in a real conflict. They're great in peacetime for overawing regions, for doing the sort of operation we see against ISIS, where we can't get air force power in quickly, and for all the good reasons that carriers are great. But I do worry about the scale of investment involved in a supercarrier, and would a US president, for example, risk it going in harm's way? I don't believe he will. I think the street fighting will be done by the smaller flat tops, perhaps with the F-35Bs in future, with the carriers way to the rear providing long-distance air power and unmanned vehicles in their very great numbers as well. That's what I believe at the moment, given the threat scenarios. They're great for holding the peace, I think, in normal times. In wartime, you know, they're fantastic also for hunting down the Imperial Japanese fleet, but it's not there anymore. Would I be without them? No, I wouldn't, because they're fantastic conventional deterrent platforms. Would I want to commit them as a politician up threat in wartime? Probably not. And I'm not sure many people would consider them going in harm's way where there is a serious threat. I'm talking about submarines, ballistic missiles that can actually steer in the terminal phase and things like that.
Not to belabor the point, but you mentioned something that you believe that you should sort of maintain that effortless supremacy or superiority was the phrase that you used. But it does seem like we do maintain within a certain realm of escalation effortless superiority, but everywhere below that we're to a point being beaten back, because the issue of the freedom of the seas is not what happens in wartime or what happens between two destroyers. It's what happens between a Coast Guard vessel and a Vietnamese fishing boat, or a bunch of Chinese fishing boats and a Taiwanese commercial vessel, or whatever the Chinese are using to smash somebody else's ship. So how do we enter into that equation, that day-to-day fray? I think, is it like New York City? Rudy Giuliani claims that he changed the city by fixing all the windows in Times Square. And to a point, it seems like China's going and Russia are going around breaking all the windows.
Good analogy, yeah.
How do we, you know, a SWAT team's not going to fix those windows. What do we do as naval powers to combat within that realm of escalation?
Well, I think you've got to encourage local countries to look after their own economic zones, their own jurisdictions and things like that. We've got to give them the training, the capacity and the support if necessary. Now, a Vietnamese vessel is going to defend his territorial seas and economic zone if he knows there's somebody there to help him if it gets really tough. I think the low-level stuff should be left to the locals, so the bilateral ties, the linkages and things like that. What's important is that when, for example, we have to demonstrate freedom of the seas going through the middle of the South China Sea, then clearly it's got to be something more than just a cutter that's going to do that, because it may lead to the Chinese or somebody else saying, like, you know, we'll go through there. And we say, well, actually, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea says we can. And so, therefore, we're going to. And in fact, the United States does a great job every year in demonstrating and proving that the freedom of the seas exists, and in fact, more than any other nation. My own view, and I say it in the book, is that you need to demand more from your allies at the lower level. You know, they might not be able to put supercarriers to sea, but they can put escorts, they can put pretty good vessels at that level to sea, and you should demand more. And where you have common interests, I think other countries should step up to the plate. There's no question about that. And I think Bob Gates, when he left office, said that 75% of NATO is paid for by the United States. Well, that's ridiculous. And it has been ridiculous. And I think European countries and your allies have got to do much more to support you around the world where their interests are concerned. That way you can force multiply, you can support traditional linkages. For example, the British can help with their Commonwealth. The French have extensive Francophone countries in Africa in particular. And one thing I have noticed, I think, with US policy recently is, whereas in the past there's been this desire to build a coalition at sea, there's much more of a push now to let local countries look after their own business with the tacit support of the United States in the background in case it gets really rough. And so whereas in the past I think you formed a posse, I think the cavalry's being held in reserve against the day, the locals can't actually sort them out for themselves.
So I know you've got a hard out at 10:30. Yeah. Before we close, I guess the two questions, I'll throw them both in at once so you can kill them at the same time, is the what you would like a reader to be the major takeaway from this book. And in writing this book or throughout your career, books, speeches, anything that you would recommend or anything you've written, you can plug your own material again, that you've read that you think is important for young professionals or college students or people interested in maritime security, building a broader understanding of sort of that realm that they're trying to grapple with.
Yeah, the takeaway, I think, is that the sea has always been the engine of globalization. Right from the time when people put to sea, it will continue to be so. The laws of physics state you cannot go anywhere in mass or for any length of time without going by sea. The Air Force haven't quite hacked it yet in taking stuff. So until that happens, you know, the sea is going to be vital both for trade and for power projection. Right at the start of the book, I say every molecule of sea is connected to another. So you and I can go down to the sea and without let or hindrance go anywhere we like in the world that's connected by the sea. That's a tremendous freedom. And the way things are today, if we're not careful, we're going to lose that freedom. something that 500 years of our ancestors have fought for, and it's just going to slip away in an absence of mind. Now, as far as other books are concerned, I would say that almost anything is good. But the key thing is that people who want to learn about the sea and about fighting at sea take the time to reflect on what they read and think, does it make sense? Is this what really happens out at sea? Is this what I would do in these circumstances? And the only way you can do that is read lots of books, both history. You must be very careful about military memoirs, because they're very, very seldom
self-aggrandizing.
Yeah, and they generally fight the campaigns that they like people like to have fought rather than they actually did.
Books like Down South of Falkland's War Diary?
No, not like that. And the reason for that is it's a diary. It was written at the time, so it doesn't have the chance of retrospective judgment. No. And so Ian Hamilton, a First World War British general, said the thing about these things is, on the day of battle, the facts can be found on the ground for the asking. By the following day, they've got their uniforms on. And that's why diaries are better than memoirs. And the reason I published the diary is because every time I read about the bits I was involved in the Falklands, it wasn't right. And so I thought, well, if that's the case, nothing else is exactly right. So I thought the only way to put the record straight and to put something out into the historic record was actually published a diary, as most of it was written the day that things happened. Most things happened. It's pretty accurate, and you know, I had perceptions at the time as a 28-year-old that perhaps I wouldn't have had as a 60-year-old now.
I'm 28 years old, and you were over fighting the Falklands War, and I'm sitting comfortably here and William and Mary recording an interview, so...
It's both... you're dumb to wish yourself in a war. You're absolutely dumb. You know, it's much better to come home and do your duty and come home. You learn a lot about yourself in combat, and the first thing you learn is whether actually, and we have an expression in the United Kingdom, whether you've got the bottle, whether you can actually do it. Everybody assumes when they go to Annapolis or to Dartmouth in the United Kingdom, when they put the uniform on, of course I can do this. You know, you don't really know until the day of battle. And even when you know the first time, you don't know the second time and things. But it's a great privilege. You learn a lot about yourself, about your profession, and your judgment about things is never the same again. Because you know decisions you make as a senior officer could lead to the deaths and injuries to your people. And that's quite a burden if you don't make the right decision rather than the smart decision that gets you on.
But we do it because it's important, and that is why you've written this book. Sir, thanks so much. This has been brilliant.
No, you're great, and thanks for sharing so much knowledge and reading the book yourself.